I went through a really rough spot in the middle of Foursquare. I was like, I just don't like this job, and there's no way out of it. And I'm just not feeling super successful at my day to day because I wasn't like passionate about the stuff I had to do. So yeah, and this, the job I'm in now is much more, it's much more well suited to my skill set, my interest, and I think what I'm like innately good at.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Dennis Crowley is the co-founder of Foursquare. You might remember Foursquare as the app for letting your friends know where you are and figuring out where they were. It let you collect points and prize badges and even coupons for going about your everyday business. But Foursquare has emerged much beyond its early uses, and its business today actually powers location experiences for more than 1 billion people around the world. Dennis, he's always been fascinated with technology. In fact, before Foursquare, he founded Dodgeball, which was one of the first location-based mobile social services companies. He ended up selling Dodgeball to Google back in 2005. And Dennis, he is one of the pioneers from the early days of Silicon Alley in New York City. In fact, he's probably one of the few ones left who are still on the front lines. I definitely wanted to see what it was like to sell a business to Google, and I wanted to see what it felt like to create an app used by 1 billion people. But of course, being the sports fan I am, the first thing I had to ask Dennis was about his Kingston Stockade Football Club. It's a semi-professional soccer team in New York's Hudson Valley that competes in the fourth division of the U.S. soccer pyramid. See, Dennis bought the team, but unlike most owners who might just sit in the luxury suite and watch, I learned Dennis takes on a much different approach.
Yeah. It's, you know, right now I'm up in Kingston, New York. It's like 2 hours outside the city. And my wife and I bought a house like 6 years ago up here. And, you know, I've been playing soccer and playing pickup a bunch. I'm not any good, but I still like to play. I like to watch. And, you know, just one day we were sitting on the porch, like, man, I wish there was like a team up here that would go and would just go watch a game, right? Or our friends could go watch a game. We'd take the kids to watch a game. And, you know, there wasn't. And so I remember I was just talking to people about why hasn't anyone ever done this before? And just no one had organized it. And I was like, well, I'll take this on as a project. And, you know, it's fourth division soccer. Like it's not a huge budget. We run the club about maybe $100,000 a year. It gets to about break even. I might lose a couple of $1,000 on it a year, but it's like, it's the most fun. It's super fun. And it's like, it brings people together. There's like 1,000 people in the stands. It gives, like, there's a lot of talented players up here. So it gives them the opportunity to play in front of a big crowd, to play in front of, you know, regional, if not national audience. Like every year, one of the guys on our squad gets picked up and usually advances to play elsewhere in the world. So we have some folks playing in Scotland and Australia and Sweden and Iceland, right? And so there's people that are like just at the edge of their career that maybe fall through the cracks, and those guys get another opportunity. Like inspires all the kids up here. It's just like it's super, super fun. It's just kind of like raw, just building stuff. And people always ask me like, oh, well, like there's no connection between like Foursquare and the soccer stuff. It's like, there is, right? Like when we started Foursquare, it was software that brings people together and software that enables people to have a shared experience. And the soccer team is the same thing. It's just like community building, bringing people together, shared experiences. It's just doing it without an app, right? So it's all the same stuff.
And I love that because I do see that parallel. And you've really started your career. You started a company called Dodgeball first, which was also about that. And I want you to just take us back to those early days and your first business, which eventually you ended up selling to Google, and where the premise came from and the idea to create this kind of location-based or check-in app.
Yeah, you know, the original kind of spark for the idea was just kind of scratching your own selfish itch, right? So there was a period in New York where all my friends worked in dot-com jobs and we were all laid off around the same time or within like the same summer. And we're all in New York just with nothing to in the summer with nothing to do during the day. And so, you know, I was like, we should build a piece of software that knows where everyone is so we can just meet up during the day and hang out. And Dodgeball was a project I worked on for 3-4 years before it really turned into anything. and it turned into something. We went to NYU and I was around a bunch of students and things like Friendster had started existing and regular people had cell phones and people were text messaging and stuff. I was also kind of directly inspired by the Marauder's Map in Harry Potter folklore. Yeah. Right. So it was this need to want to build something that connected my 10 friends back when we were laid off, and then kind of seeing the lens through the Marauder's Map of like, oh, this is a good vision for this product. Like every city in the world should see all the people moving around all the time, because that's how you can make interesting and serendipitous connections, to going to NYU and having an audience to present it in front of, you know, fellow classmates and students and, you know, people that would just come to NYU to see what we were working on. And, you know, all those things kind of came together at the right time in 2004, 2005, which led us to Google.
Right. And then you get acquired, obviously, by Google. And tell me about that, because, you know, you're a really young guy. I mean, you're still young. But at that point, you say to yourself, you started this kind of on a whim while at NYU. And then all of a sudden, you have this acquisition. And what was that change like, going from being an entrepreneur, running your own business, then to going to Google, which was just probably, you know, starting and on the rise? I mean, they were well established, but on the rise at that point.
Yeah. I mean, there's this like mythology around like the Dodgeball acquisition was a huge high dollar acquisition, you know, which is not true. It was an acqui-hire. There was two of us. Like Dodgeball wasn't a functioning business. Like we were two, you know, my co-founder, Alex, and I, two grad school kids, you know, coming out of like art grad school in NYU with this interesting product idea. We were trying to go out and raise money for it from venture capitalists, and we were having zero luck at all.
Right.
People were just not interested in the story that we were telling. I think we were probably doing a crappy version of selling the future of it anyway. So first and foremost, it was like we were stressed leaving NYU, being like, what are we going to do for jobs?
Right.
Like we have to get a job. What's going to be our job? And then, you know, Alex and I had this kind of epiphany around the time of graduation, just when Dodgeball started getting some press, you know, like the New York Times wrote about it and a couple blogs wrote about it. It's like, maybe this is supposed to be our job. Maybe if we just work on this for 6 months, it'll turn into something else, something we can't yet see. And so that's what we did. We kind of committed to each other that we would work on this for a little bit. And then when you know, we started talking to Google, which was just like a super serendipitous thing, like I had presented like the academic side of our Dodgeball thesis project, you know, at a conference in like somewhere in California.
Right.
And, you know, some people from Google were in the audience like, this is awesome. We'd love to hear more about it. Come to headquarters. And that's kind of where the story started. But when we got acquired, for us, it was like, oh my gosh, we have a job.
We have health
insurance. You know, they give us free lunch every day. Like we were eating at that pizza place around the corner from the Tisch Building, NYU, like literally every single meal.
Was that Mercado?
Pizza Mercado.
I used to live at 300 Mercer for years.
Okay.
Way before your time, but.
I always tell the story to the NYU kids and they're like, I'm like, listen, Pizza Mercado. I got the chicken parm sub with the pepperonis on it every day.
So good. It's so funny. You know, it's really so great. You know, like when you hear that, and we have a lot of listeners who are just starting out and entrepreneurs and, you know, they don't realize, you know, now you've gone through building, selling Dodgeball and building Foursquare and becoming this big tech entrepreneur. But like, what's so great is it starts in little pizza shops or it starts in little offices, and it starts by you just being excited, like you said, to have a job. Can you tell me about then starting out again, and let's talk about Foursquare and just the challenges and how you were feeling? Because as an entrepreneur, a lot of times there's so many challenges. And when we do these shows, there's so much success and talk about success. But being an entrepreneur is so many ups and downs. And can you take me back to those early days and kind of relaunching and starting Foursquare?
Yeah. I mean, like when we left Google, I kind of chalked Dodgeball up as a failure, right? It's like we had this thing, we sold it, we made a little bit of money off of it. But at the end of the day, like it didn't get to 10 million people. It didn't get to, you know, it wasn't widely adopted by the Google mothership and pushed out to everyone on the planet, which is kind of what we were going for. And so the day that we left, I'll never forget, like the day that Alex and I left and we got in the Google elevator for the last time, it's like we just left all that behind. Like we don't own it anymore. They're not our users. Yeah. It's not our code. It's just like that project is dead. We have to move on. And then Alex and I, we kind of went our separate ways for a bit. I went and, you know, I took a couple months off, and then I worked at another buddy's startup for a little bit. Alex bounced around from two other jobs. And then it was probably about a year and a half later where Google announced that they were going to turn off Dodgeball. Just like, this is a service that not a lot of people are using. It's not very well maintained. We're just going to turn it off. And then when we heard that, I was at a buddy's birthday party when the news broke. It's like, if they're going to turn that off, like, we're just going to make another one. Like, we still use it. Our friends all use it. Like, the reason we all met up tonight is because we used it.
Right.
We'll just make another one. But I'll tell you, like, I was pretty down on myself at the time. Like, I didn't have a job that I was super psyched about. I was kind of convinced that dodgeball didn't work. I wasn't sure what was going to be next. I thought that was going to be my one shot to really make something that was meaningful. Like, I went through like a depression period like that summer, which is probably the worst that I felt in my career, really. And it wasn't until we started building things again and pushing them back out to people and getting positive feedback from those people, from our friends, that like I started to feel good again. And, you know, I think in this whole process we've been doing Foursquare like 12 years and then, you know, a couple of years of dodgeball and other stuff before then. I think that the thing that I've been able to learn about myself is that like I need to like create and build things and push them out to people and get feedback on it. Like I need that feedback loop in order to feel like fulfilled as a person. And when I don't have that, I go crazy. Like personally and mentally, I'm just not like healthy when I'm not doing that stuff. And so now that I know that and I have the awareness of doing that, I'm constantly trying to keep myself busy with new stuff, like the soccer team, like side projects, all the weird R&D projects we work on at Foursquare, because that's the thing that kind of keeps me going and motivates me and gives me like good positive energy.
Yeah, you know, that's really interesting, because as the life of an entrepreneur, myself being one and starting a couple businesses and going through the process, you just talked about it, like that time frame of really feeling depressed and trying to figure out what makes you happy, because most people might look at this and be like, oh, wow, this dude started this company, sold it to Google, but yet your mindset was you thought you failed. And it sounds like you've changed that, but was that a motivator for you back then to say, now I want to succeed? Did you use that, or did that not come into play?
No, it's an interesting conversation, because like different people are motivated by different things. And like the success part of it has not been like a thing that has motivated me. And I think I learned that through Google. Like we made some money through the Google acquisition, but I was like, it ultimately doesn't really change anything. Like the thing that I need to stay fulfilled is to build things, and to build things that are interesting, that people think are interesting, that people like to use, and to get that feedback. That's just what drives me. You know, different people are driven by different things. And so a big chunk of my existence at Foursquare has been about like trying to continue to invent, right? Let's make things that push the city guide space a little bit forward, the push location technology a little bit forward, the push like what you can do technically with mobile phones in terms of bringing people together. Let's do that. Let's push that stuff forward. Even with the soccer team, like it like wasn't like, I'm going to buy a team. Like that's not interesting.
Right,
like let's make it from scratch, and then let's write blog posts about it, and let's use those blog posts to teach other people how to do it. And then let's get all those people together and try to change the system. I mean, that's a whole different conversation, but we're trying to do something in a different way because it's more interesting to do it that way. Because that's the thing that I enjoy to do.
I love hearing that, because what it seems to me like, you're a person who really likes to build, likes to help, likes to create. And so many people lose track of that when they're starting businesses and want to sell their business and make money, and you lose sight. It's so refreshing to really understand kind of your mindset, and love hearing that and just the realness. So with Foursquare now, and just so you can give some of our listeners, because I think it's so relevant right now, I was thinking just with COVID, can you give them just a quick background on Foursquare, and obviously from the start, what it's become, what it really is now, maybe just so they understand. And then I'd love to talk to you about what you're doing now, especially because it must be relevant with COVID.
Yeah. So, I mean, Foursquare, the company's been around almost 12 years, it'll be 12 years in January. I think we have about somewhere between 350 and 400 employees. There's a handful of offices around the world. In the last year, we've joined forces with two other companies, acquired a company called Placed out of Seattle, and then Factual out of LA. So it's like three companies with all in the location technology space coming together, which has been really interesting. We started as a consumer app, and you know, everyone kind of knows this as the check-in app.
Yeah.
But, you know, like we had this vision early on of like, listen, we're going to have to make a check-in button that people don't have to press, because like, it's just not realistic that everyone's going to press a check-in button everywhere they go. And the journey to build that thing, the check-in button you don't have to press, is now a product called Pilgrim, a piece of technology called Pilgrim, which is productized in the form of the Pilgrim SDK, which people can put into their apps. And then once they put in your apps, your apps kind of understand, oh, this app just walked into a coffee shop. Oh, this app just walked into a gym. Oh, this app is in the supermarket for the first time this week. And you can make interesting things happen. And the interesting things vary depending on what segment you're in. But there's, you know, people that use that for advertising, which, you know, I want to show ads to people that go to these types of places. For advertising measurement, I want to measure the effectiveness of the ad to drive someone to the store. You can use it for analytics, like how many people are coming to my store versus your store, and let's do it over this month or that month. Developers use it. There's a whole bunch of apps that are using not just the Pilgrim SDK, but our API and our POI data set in order to make their products richer in terms of, you know, location information, whether it's, you know, names and addresses of places, photos, metadata, or just information about like, where do people go? Like, where do people go after they go to this place? Where are the if I go to these places in New York, where should I go when I go to Paris, right? So we, Foursquare as a location technology company, has access, you know, just this like wealth of knowledge about like, what are the things in the world that people go to, who go to those places, what type of people go there, and then what else do they do? And you can put all those little Lego blocks together in all sorts of interesting ways.
And that's incredible, because when I remembered Foursquare, you know, at the start, and I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. It's fun. You know, I remember you become the mayor of a certain location and, you know, but then I really started thinking, later on, I was like, holy shit, you know, this is actually pretty genius because of the data that you are able to collect and know where people are moving. And with that said, tell me how many users now, and then also, you guys have to be involved in somewhere. I'm sure there's some government agencies talking to you guys now, because you just have this wealth of information that could really be helpful.
Yeah, there's, I mean, to your first point, it's probably worth just acknowledging that there's kind of like three phases to this whole, I guess, like the Foursquare journey, as well as my own personal journey. Yeah. There's like the accidentally stumbled into something really interesting, which is dodgeball. And it's like, hey, we want to build a Marauders map. This helps me and my buddies go out and, you know, have a good time 7 nights a week. And that's what that was for. When we brought that to Google, I remember going through just the data set that we had. I mean, we were smarter at that time. I think Google made us smarter about the way to think about things. And we will be able to look through the data being like, holy cow, when people check into places, like you can start to string these breadcrumbs together and predict where people will go, or to prescribe places for people to go to. And then by the time we started Foursquare, like we weren't like messing around. Like we knew what we had to build. We knew we had to make a machine that generated check-ins, which is where all the game mechanics came from. Right. Let's gamify it. And then we knew if we had enough check-in data, we would eventually get to that point where we could do the check-in button you don't have to press. And now that we're there, there's all this crazy stuff we can do with it, to your second point. So yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of people that want to work with us. I think what's great is like we can be selective about the people that we want to work with. We traditionally have not worked with government agencies. It's just something we haven't been interested in.
Yeah, I could understand.
However, now with COVID, coronavirus, you know, shelter in place, trying to understand what's happening out in the real world, we have been kind of retooling some of our dashboards and some of our like kind of analytics products, gearing them specifically towards like county officials and city officials. Some of the stuff we know makes it into different governors' briefing books, so they can help make decisions as to, okay, are people out and about? And what does it look like county by county? And are people obeying the shelter in place orders, or are they not? And so we've been doing a lot of this since March. And my job at Foursquare, co-founder and executive chair, but that's not really a job. Those are just titles. But my job is that I run the Foursquare R&D group, which is just like a small scrappy group that the mandate is like make interesting things with Foursquare tools and technology. And the interesting things that we are working on now are like spinning up new tools, new dashboards, new like expressions of data.
More from our guest, but first a word from our sponsors. You want to know how success really happens? You cultivate a well-informed, well-trained sales team. Top-producing sales professionals are knowledgeable about what they sell. They understand the market and the needs of their prospects, and they're skilled at overcoming objections. So what do you do when you're an expert in sales but not in training? Turn to Rise.com, the online training system sales teams love. Rise.com is an all-in-one system that makes online training easy to create, enjoyable to take, and simple to manage. Not only can you create, distribute, and analyze sales training easily in Rise.com, you also get tons of training content that's beautiful, well-researched, and enjoyable for learners. Help your team succeed with useful product guides, insightful market information, and a safe environment to practice real-world scenarios. Are you ready to train your sales team better? Start a free 30-day trial at rise.com/HSH. That's rise.com/HSH.
And our next sponsor.
Ready to start your own business, but don't know where to start? Well, the dark days are over. Entrepreneur has just released a new online course that walks you through the entire process of starting your own business, from testing out your idea to getting funding to get your business off the ground. And here's the best part. If you go to entrepreneur.com/SYOB, you can take the first three lessons for free. You immediately get access to videos, worksheets, and quizzes. And at the end, you'll get a personalized one-page business brief on your idea that you can share with investors, partners, family members, and friends for feedback. And seriously, it's free. Check it out at entrepreneur.com/SYOB.
And we're back. I want to ask you, because to me, it sounds like what you're doing now, going back to what really makes you happy, it seems like you're in a real place right now of creating products, because you've ran the business for a while and now you are heading up R&D. Is that true?
Is it true that I'm now doing
R&D? You're happier now.
Yeah. I mean, I was a CEO of Foursquare for like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. Yeah. And I've talked a bunch about this publicly, but I had a conversation with the board one day. I was like, I don't like being CEO. I like to build things in small teams. I like to build things that don't have immediate revenue implications. Like, that's what I'm good at. I can be the front man for the company, but like, you need a strategic operator in this role if you really want the company to be what it's going to be. And, you know, the board helped me run basically a 2-year process to replace myself, which, you know, I'm thankful to have a board that was supportive of that. And I went through a really rough spot in the middle of Foursquare. I was like, I just don't like this job, and there's no way out of it. And I'm just not feeling super successful at my day to day because I wasn't like passionate about the stuff I had to do. So yeah, and the job I'm in now is much more well suited to my skill set, my interest, and I think what I'm innately good at.
Yeah. How do you get through those times? And, you know, for like our listeners and entrepreneurs where, you know, it's just sometimes it's a struggle and it's a grind and it's such a roller coaster ride. What's your mindset to really get through those periods and then just to help yourself?
I do believe there's kind of like this bullshit, just grind and hustle till you make it, like startup culture, yeah, which I think is really kind of disingenuous. I don't know any way to make it through this stuff without having some like a good sense of self-awareness. And I think the self-awareness comes from either writing about it or talking to friends about it or talking to like a mentor or a coach about it. Like, I've been blessed to have a couple great executive coaches that have worked with Foursquare over a couple of years, as well as good, thoughtful board of directors that are able to listen to feedback. Like other connections to, I don't want to call them mentors, so to speak, but like just other people in the industry where it's like, how did you get through this phase? Like, what did you do? What did you do to figure this out? And I write a lot of stuff that I don't publish, right? Sure. And that helps me think about stuff. And then, you know, I talk to my wife and my friends and the board and CEO coach when I need to. And like, it's really the only way to do it. And also, I do a lot of this stuff too.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's like a podcast or you're speaking to a group of students, like this is how I kind of work through my thoughts. Is like, you ask me interesting questions. Some of them are like questions I haven't had answered before. And like, cool. It helps me solidify those answers and think about them at the same time. And so I appreciate doing this stuff.
Yeah. Do you get a lot of people? Do you get recognized? Do you get entrepreneurs who come up to you and might thank you for a speech and kind of spark them maybe on a journey?
I get that more often than you may imagine, given that, like, you know, Foursquare is not a huge technology company. Back in the day when we used to use airports, you know, like I would,
I forgot about those days.
Not uncommon to like go on a trip somewhere and like someone say hi in both in both airports, right? Or to go, I remember, you know, I went to like the MLS All-Star game and like someone came up to me in the stands like, hey man, I saw a talk that you gave at whatever, Berkeley or Stanford, whatever it was, to my class, and it was so inspiring. I just want to know, I went out and started a company, but it didn't work. But then I ended up getting this job at this other place. I'm like, man, that's awesome. Like, yeah, I don't even remember that talk from 5 years ago. Like, you do, and that's meaningful for me. That's like, to be honest, like, of all the stuff that we've done, like, the most meaningful personal stuff that comes out of it is when I get to have these interactions with people that are like, hey, I heard what you said and it inspired me to do something that I would normally have not have done. And I went out and did it and it worked or it didn't work. Because I mean, that's the experience that I personally had. Like, I moved to the city and I was kind of wowed, this like right after college, by, oh my God, the city is so big. And there's a whole .com scene. And I worked for this company called Jupiter Communications. And the founder was, you know, on this pedestal for me and this working with the smartest people I'd ever met. And then I went to this other startup called Vindigo right after that. And, you know, I worked a 30-person company. I worked alongside, I sat next to the co-founder. And I was just like, these guys are just normal guys. Yeah. Like, this is, these are normal people that just went out and started something because they had a good idea. Like, I want to be these people when I grow up. So I feel like I had that gift given to me from great people at Jupiter and great people at Vindigo. And, you know, whenever people ask me like, hey, can you speak to my class or do something? I'm always like, I'm happy to do that because like, I feel like it's your job to pay it forward. And part of paying it forward is telling people like, there's nothing easy or glamorous about the ride. And it like, it will has a good chance of like sinking you into depression and making your life and miserable. And, you know, but it's like, if you are the type of person that has these things in your head that you just want to make, like, this is the way that you do that. You know, this is the best way to do it.
I love that. I want to talk about New York because you started this business, obviously went to NYU, but really, like, you talk about those times back in the 90s, late 90s, I guess it was. And it was such an incredible time here, being personally living in New York City and always being here. It was such an incredible time. I want you to talk about, kind of like you just did a little bit, but really why you always decided to stay here and build your business here when I am sure out west or in San Francisco, there's probably so much more access to talent and capital. Was that a conscious decision?
Yeah. I mean, like, I just really like New York. I'm from right outside Boston. I went to school at Syracuse, upstate New York. And then I moved down to the city right after that. And I just kind of fell in love with the city. Just like a lot of art, a lot of culture, a lot of diversity, just a lot of things going on all the time. And just that, I just like that. I didn't have exposure to that growing up, and I just kind of fell in love with the city. And then, you know, kind of quickly fell in love with like this idea of like making cities easier to use, build software that makes cities easier to use. New York was hard for me to adjust to. How do I make that easier for people? It's just, we got to start working on that stuff like 2 years into living in New York. New York has these like weird like ebbs and flows though, right? Like, I moved down in a super frothy time where in the middle of dot-com heydays and companies were worth a ton of money. A lot of those companies went out of business. And so I was there at the crazy peak, and then I got laid off from Vindigo in 2000 or 2001. Yeah, 2001, right? And then it was in a really lousy time. That was right around 9/11, right? Like, I left the city after that. I moved up to New Hampshire. I worked as a snowboard instructor because there's no other jobs to have.
Yeah.
And then I decided, like, what am I going to do? I'm going to come back to the city. I'm going to move back to the city, and I'm going to go to grad school. And I went to grad school at NYU. And there was a little bit of a tech scene, but it wasn't like the 1998, 1999 tech scene, right? And one of the magical things about coming back to New York in 2002 when we went to NYU is that the only people that were doing internet stuff then were people that just loved the internet, and they loved what the internet could do, and they loved the promise of the internet. In 2000, this is interesting. I've never read like a book or an article that discusses this, but like in 1997, 98, 99, like, everyone was in the internet because it was just like a gold rush. So anyone from any industry was in the internet. And then what happened is, like, when all those jobs went away, people went back to what they were doing before. They got kind of wowed by the internet. And then the only people working on stuff 2000, 2004 were people that were like, we're going to invent the next version of the internet, that sustainable version of the internet that works. And that was, you know, that's when things like Google Maps were starting to come online. That's when cell phones were starting to, you know, get digital connections so they could move. You had a web browser on your phone, like mobile internet, right? SMS. And so, like, it was just this, like, our class at NYU at ITP at that time was just like, just super, super rich in terms of just creative talent and commitment to making cool stuff. And then things get super, super frothy again, and then they don't. And then they were, and then they're not, right? So what happens when people go back to New York, Like, what does it look like? Is it a totally different city? Are there totally new opportunities? You know, in terms of building new products, building things for city, using technology for good. It's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I know you have like a first front row seat in many respects. What do you think it's going to be like in people coming back, especially, you know, as you walk around New York now and it's ghost town, but, you know, we're opening back up. And what do you anticipate?
From a
standpoint of how people will actually go back to going into locate stores. Like you said, everything for you is about, and me, it's connection, community. I crave that right now. Do you think it's from that standpoint, it's just going to take a lot of time to get back to that? And do you think things will eventually or soon enough get back to normal?
Yeah, I think it's probably like it's somewhere between like a year and 2 years where things go back to normal. This is like my non-epidemiologist opinion. But I, you know, there's all these, I'm reading all these articles like New York is dead. This is the death of cities. It's not the death of cities, right? People go to cities for certain reasons, right? The same stuff that drew me to cities back in 1998, and that will continue to be the thing. And, you know, I do think in the next year or so is a little bit of a little Wild West. There'll be new crop of software that is like, hey, I'm going to show you my phone that proves that I have been properly socially distancing, that I got a test in the last 48 hours, right? The stuff that it would seem super invasive from like a health and technology perspective 6 months ago will just be, I think it will just be part of regular life. You know, I think city guides and software that helps people find places, like a category that will still exist, will never go away. But of course, things will be tailored, like which places are safe, which places my friends are going to, which places are not crowded. I don't want to go to the crowded places. I'm going to not crowded places. You know, Foursquare is an interesting position to like, we have good data on what's crowded and just kind of flip the algorithm around. What's not crowded? What's starting to come back online? What is kind of over the threshold of too busy? So I think we can be helpful with a lot of this stuff. I think the bigger opportunity is like, how do people reimagine work? So like we have this conversation internally at Foursquare. When will the office be open in the same way that it was before? I mean, that might be a long time. So how do we, like, if we have this space that we have leased and paid for, like, how do you put that to use? Like, the floor plans probably get reimagined. Which groups come in on which days probably get reimagined. People's relationship with working from home gets reimagined. I'm watching, I mean, up in Kingston now, but I'm watching New York from afar, where it's like, is this the moment that pushes cars to one lane and bike lanes to a full lane? There's just lots of like urban infrastructure stuff that's starting to get changed, not to even speak of like what's going to happen in terms of helping people find work that they're passionate about. There's going to be a lot of like unemployed, underemployed people, like what happens to colleges, to learning, distance learning, you know, my whether it's colleges or whether it's preschool where my kids are at, like it's all this stuff's up in the air.
Yeah, it's so crazy. I mean, I have two kids, two girls, and go to schools here in the city, and you just don't, it's so much is up in the air and so many things we don't know. But I love that because I think, especially for entrepreneurs, this is when people come up with really good ideas and put them into play and start going for it. And for you guys now at Foursquare, you talked about the acquisitions that you've made. What is there any change of direction? If you were to say what Foursquare will look like in a couple years and the path you're on, can you talk about what you foresee?
Yeah. You know, like I think the big change for Foursquare over the last couple years is company generates a significant amount of revenue now, right? And so we went through a period in the 12 years of Foursquare, like went through periods of like, I don't know how we're going to make any money. To periods of like, okay, we're making money, but not enough money. To periods of like, okay, now we have a whole bunch of products, but like they don't have wide enough distribution. To last year was our first year we were over $100 million in revenue. And that's a real significant number and milestone and like an exclusive club that you get to be in as part of a startup where it's like, okay, this company has the opportunity to really do great things. Right. And be self-sufficient, be profitable, and then, you know, just do great stuff off of that. From a, like a vision technology perspective, like it goes back to the original idea of if you made a check-in button that people never had to press and you had this awareness of where phones are, where they're going, to predict where they might go in the future, you can build the amazing things with that. And, you know, that's what we're doing in our R&D group. Like my bias is towards trying to build these things that can really show you New York as a living, breathing city, like heat maps that are updated every second of where devices are. Right. And so let me just address this. It's like when I talk about this stuff, I get excited about it. People are like, gosh, that sounds like dystopian. Like every phone on a map, you know, there's ways to do this in which privacy is protected. Data is anonymized. Data is aggregated. But in the same way, like Amazon will show you things like, oh, people that bought this also bought this. We can do that in real time for things that are on a street, for things that are potentially in a store, for things in different neighborhoods, for things all around the world, right? And so there's really interesting work to be done. And then there's this whole category of contextual aware computing, which is a fancy word that really just means software that changes based on where you are, software that changes based on where you take it. This idea that Alexa that's sitting on my bookshelf over there, it doesn't know anything about me when I leave the house and go out in the real world. Like I do all sorts of interesting things in the real world. Like Alexa should know those things and be like, hey, today's supermarket day, or like, hey, I saw you went to these two places. You should try this place again, right? Alexa should be talking to me, you know, on my watch or in my car. Like Siri, maybe if I really ask Siri something, maybe it does that. Like a lot of these things, like they're not proactive either. You know, like we have this big, we talk a lot about this internally, like Siri, Alexa, all these things, they're like a genie in a lamp, and you have to rub the lamp to get the genie to come out by saying like, hey, Siri, or whatever. But like, where is the thing where Siri wakes up and says something to me because something interesting happened? Because my buddy's in the store next door, because I just walked by someone and I didn't notice them and I wanted to say hi. You know, like this is one of the things that we're actively working on at Foursquare, which was, you know, I have these wired headphones in, but like we were working on a version of Foursquare that was just for the AirPods, right? So you put them in and it talks to you as you walk around the city, like, oh, your buddy Alex is over here and this coffee shop is great. Like, it's absolutely the last piece of software that the world needs at this moment in time.
Yeah, totally.
But you know, when you talk about getting back to normal, like that's where it's going. And that's what Foursquare will power. So like, that was a long answer, but like, I want the company to be able to power those next generation location services that change the way that people interact with the real world.
Yeah, no, I think you guys, I mean, are in an incredible place right now, just how much the world has changed and how you kind of pivoted and just now being at the front of these conversations with the importance of data. And one thing, you know, I've noticed about you guys, what I like is that you always seem pretty transparent. You know, there's a lot of these third-party apps and stuff. You never know, like, and we know, like, and I'm the type of person that's fine with it. Like, I want information, but it seems like that's always been one of the most important things that's really been your brand ethos is to be transparent.
Yeah, when we started building all this stuff back at NYU, like you're just building software for your friends, right? And no one's ever trying to screw over their friends. You're just making software, right? And so, you know, like we, from the very, very beginning, like back in our NYU days, like, you know, we make the service, it's your data. You want to delete it? Delete it. You want to delete some of it? You want to delete all of it? I don't care. It's your data. Go delete it. When we went to Google, we were kind of pleasantly surprised. Like we were at Google during the Don't Be Evil days, where it's like our philosophy on data and privacy and ownership like aligned perfectly with theirs. Like, yeah, it's users' data. They do whatever they want with it. We're just the service provider.
Right.
You know, and so we've always brought that ethos to Foursquare too, right? Where, you know, we make this stuff, you do whatever you want with your data. You want to export it, you want to delete it, whatever. And so I think a big part of that is being transparent. Like we have crazy technology now that does all sorts of interesting things that can understand where your device goes. I want to be, we like in our apps on the website, we show people the data we have about them. We allow them to control it, edit it, delete it, opt out entirely. And I think that's the only way to do it. I think one of the proudest things, one of the things I'm most proud of the, you know, in the history of the company is that our former CEO, Jeff Glick, he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, I guess it was last summer, about, listen, the location technology industry needs to be regulated by the government because there are a lot of bad actors. And here's how we think that the government should regulate it. And if you want to come and talk to us, we're happy to help. We think we are the good actors. We are transparent. We think we do the right things. We think we are like the industry leader in terms of like doing the right thing. And that's a really like, it was well written and is like a very like poetic statement about like, where does Foursquare stand in terms of like ethics and privacy and leadership on this?
And you know, I think to that point, like, and this was obviously before what we're going through now, but, and I'm interested if the government actually, which I probably doubt, but came to you and or has put in or implemented steps to regulate it. But I would imagine right now that conversation is even more prevalent, not from a standpoint of like Orwellian, you know, just keeping an eye on it, but really because now more than ever, it's so important to be able to track our population in a democratic way, you know, or in a democracy, how you do that. But like, I would just imagine like we need to do that and you need to regulate it because there's so many people who are probably trying to do it on their own and not in an ethical way.
Yeah. I mean, like the word track really gets people amped up, right? And to be, and no, but I mean, a lot of the companies in the space, that's what they do, right? Piece of software on your phone, it understands the places that you've been to. So, you know, technically it's tracking, right? The question is always, and this comes back to the companies that create this stuff. It's like, A, did they communicate what the software was doing? Like, hey, this thing's going to be always on. It's going to collect your information. B, did they communicate why they need that data? When we have this data, this is what we do with it. We want to make these awesome services. We want to make the genie pop out of the lamp on its own. In exchange for that, there's advertising and analytics purposes. And so a lot of it is, and then the third part is this, like, do you trust the company? Like, does the company have a good history of building interesting stuff? Stuff that's worth your time, stuff that's worth your data, stuff that's worth you taking a risk on this company. And you know, some companies pass that test for users and some companies don't, right? Yeah. And I've always thought that we, Foursquare, have been a good mix of, hey, we're able to monetize this stuff because that's what we need to do to stay around. We're able to invent the future and kind of push the boundaries of what we can do and invent what we think is the future of location services. And then we've always been like, thoughtful, ethical, transparent, and articulate about like, here's what we're doing, here's why we do it, here's what we think is right, here's what we think is wrong, right? Here's where we think the industry should go. And I think for us, like those are the three things that you need to do to be a leader in space.
Two more quick things for you before we let you go. One is, as an entrepreneur now, it's so hard, like you said, and like we know everyone's working from home. How have you been able to maintain your productivity? What's your daily routine like, that you might be able to share with us that could be helpful?
Yeah, it's a great question. Actually, I'd love to listen to a podcast of just 1,000, not 1,000,
see what it's like.
20 answers like this. Yeah, I think I am more productive in a lot of ways, right? Because I'm not in meetings a lot of the time. But I also think I'm less productive because I think I work best when I have like three people around me and we're all like whiteboarding together and brainstorming. And we're having a hard time doing that, you know, to be honest, with my little team. Like the meeting that I have right after this is with that team. We meet every day and we talk about stuff. It's like, it's got creative energy, but it doesn't have the same level of creative energy. I will tell you my three best tricks, which I figured out in the first 2 weeks of being in quarantine, was that I started blocking off just time for myself on my calendar. So I put Dennis goes to work at 10 a.m. and Dennis is done at work at 5 p.m. just to set some boundaries.
Yeah.
And I blocked off some time to exercise, eat lunch, hang out with the kids in the middle there. And then I let people fill in the stuff around me. It sounds obvious, but it's
it's unfortunately not, it's not. You know, I think a lot of people are struggling through this, and the reason I asked someone like yourself is like so people can realize. You know, I think people, especially in this time, put a lot of pressure on themselves of, you know, because it's such a different scenario than being in an office, having a whiteboard, like, and just, it's been just such a tough time for so many people that these types of ideas and tips could be really helpful, especially if you're starting and building a business right now.
We also told the team, the company, like it sounds weird because everyone's at home, but if you need to take a vacation day at home, like go take a personal day. Like go watch Netflix all day long, go on a hike, do something, you know, don't even leave your house. Just get off the internet if you have to. Like, this is like this whole thing, everyone working from home all the time, everyone like I'm in this chair all day long. I'm on Zoom half the day. Like it's exhausting in ways that like we're just not used to being exhausted, and you need to kind of take care of yourself. No. That's like a totally non-obvious thing to like take a vacation day.
I know, but it's so weird because you are at home and you don't. Yeah. It's just such a confusing time. And for me, as someone who loves to connect and I love New York City, I love community. Like I can't wait to get back and checking into places and that's going to be incredible. But the last question I have for you is about where we started with your Stockade team. What's the, like, are you guys, is the season starting? Have you put plans into place yet? How is that going to work?
Season's canceled. season was canceled this year, right? Which is, I'm on the board of directors for the league too. And so I was involved in the discussions and we were kind of like waffling, do you cancel or not? It's like, this thing, we're going to be living with coronavirus for a while. Yeah. Like the question is not, do we cancel it in 2020? The question is, are we going to have to cancel it in 2021?
Right.
And so, I mean, I was just texting with the guys from the team last night, you know, the head coach and technical director. We have a whole staff. It's, yeah. It's like a mini company. And it's just like, this normally is the most fun time of the year for me, where it's like you go to work and work at Foursquare and you're at the office and you're cranking, it's summertime in the city and it's awesome. Oh, so and then good. you come up on Friday and it's like, we got a game on Saturday. So I got to go awesome. To Staples. I got to pick up the programs and you know, get the food vendors lined up and go early and talk to the coach. And it's just like, there's usually just so much energy during this time of the year. And it's like this big, you know, this thing I've been working on 5 years. I love the Stockade project. We just don't have it. I don't have that. And I don't have all this other stuff in my life either. And it's just like, it's hard in a lot of ways. And you know, it's everything else is going on in the world. Like the world just feels upside down in general. And so it's a challenging time for everyone. And I think everyone's just trying to do their best to hold it together.
Yeah. Well, I hope a lot of our listeners got a lot out of this and hanging in there and myself included. It's been a real pleasure hearing your story and love your authenticity and honesty. And that makes for a great show. So awesome. Thanks so much, Dennis.
Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
You got it.
All right, see ya.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning. And you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.